This week, New Hampshire voters gave former President Donald Trump another win. How's the 2024 contest shaping up?
Strong performance, give President Biden some momentum going into South Carolina. And for Donald Trump, of course, it does the same thing on the Republican side.
The U.S. and Russia both met with African leaders this week. What's the strategic importance of the continent to Washington and Moscow?
The focus is definitely on security. And you can see that both in the kinds of conversations that they're having and in the places that they're visiting.
And how Israel is observing International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Steve Miller, in again for Lori London. This week, New Hampshire voters gave decisive wins to candidates on Tuesday in one of the first votes leading to the 2024 presidential election. The contest propelled former President Donald Trump closer to the Republican nomination. Coming off a first-place finish in the Iowa caucuses, he now has a New Hampshire primary win, and in his victory speech, he sounded as if he'd already moved on to November.
You know, we won New Hampshire three times now, three. We win it every time. We win the primary, we win the generals, we've won it, and it's a very, very special place to me. It's very important.
However, Trump's former UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, also says that she's not quitting the race.
A presidential candidate has to get 1,215 delegates. Donald Trump has 32, and I have 17. So we are not going to sit there and just give up.
Meanwhile, the United Auto Workers Union endorsed U.S. President Joe Biden's re-election bid on Wednesday, with Union President Sean Fain delivering a fiery speech in Washington that was also harshly critical of former President Trump.
Joe Biden bet on the American worker while Donald Trump blamed the American worker.
To discuss the results as well as where perhaps the 2024 election heads next, I spoke with University of Mary Washington Political Science and International Affairs Chair Rosalind Cooperman. I guess where I want to begin is with New Hampshire. We had the Trump victory, Nikki Haley placing about 11% behind the former president, and Joe Biden winning his write-in campaign there. So given all that, what are your major takeaways from this first-in-the-nation primary?
Perhaps Nikki Haley wishes she had done a bit better. That certainly was the expectation and the wish, particularly for folks within the party structure. And there are a few that still exist, to be sure, who would have liked an alternative to Donald Trump. It doesn't look like that's going to happen, of course. And so in that regard, the New Hampshire primary helped Donald Trump get a step closer to securing the 2024 nomination. Of course, there's an asterisk with that, given the federal indictments that he faces, I guess, at both the federal and the state level. But nonetheless, in terms of awarding delegates, the rules of the game for awarding delegates anyway, it puts both President Biden closer to securing the nomination. But that notwithstanding, that strong performance as a write-in candidate helps give President Biden some momentum going into South Carolina. And for Donald Trump, of course, it does the same thing on the Republican side.
You mentioned the path towards the Republican nomination has an asterisk next to Donald Trump's name. Sure, he won Iowa. He won New Hampshire. But as Nikki Haley said in her speech after the New Hampshire primaries, it's only 2 out of 48 states, and she's not willing to throw in the towel just yet. But, you know, some people are saying, some analysts are saying the path and the math, so to speak, don't necessarily add up for her to get the nomination. And I wanted to get your take on how Haley is running her campaign. And as we move forward to other states, especially South Carolina, where she is the former governor, but significant Republican leadership in that state have already thrown their support behind Donald Trump. You know, what's at stake and what does she need to do?
Sure. Well, I think that Nikki Haley is making a point as long as she stays in, right? I think that this notion of having an alternative to Donald Trump, even if the math doesn't necessarily add up at this point, given the trajectory, given the fact that you have members of the party, particularly you see members of Congress, for example, stepping in line, giving Trump their endorsement. It's unclear in that regard how much of that has to do with the expectation, you know, Donald Trump. And so the idea of not stepping in line opens you up to primary challenges. It opens you up to nastiness on social media and attention that Republican office holders may be inclined to want to avoid, all things being equal, right? And so I think that that's certainly an element of it. Polls do have Nikki Haley trailing Donald Trump in her own home state. And I think that, again, the goal perhaps for the Haley campaign would be to stay in at least through Super Tuesday when 16 states hold their primary, including obviously the Commonwealth of Virginia, but also California, Texas, where you have those delegate-rich states, so to speak, because of their size, that will really determine if there is a viable path for anyone else. And that anyone else at this point is Nikki Haley, who really is, you know, continuing to move on. She has money. She has certainly some name recognition, some interest. But the issue becomes, does she draw a strong enough contrast as something else beyond what Donald Trump is offering? And right now, at least, party delegates don't seem to be so interested in that alternative.
And you know, moving forward, we have three major candidates that we're talking about: Donald Trump, Nikki Haley, and Joe Biden. What do you see as the primary difficulties, the challenges that they need to overcome to secure their respective party nominations? I mean, Donald Trump is the front runner for Republicans. Joe Biden is the presumptive nominee for the Democrats. But, you know, what are the challenges that you see out there?
I think that a lot of folks have made much about challenges facing candidates, and I think that's certainly the case. But if we're talking about the nominations, what I would say is this: on the Republican side, the reality is that the Republican Party culture is one that is hierarchical in nature. And right now, Donald Trump remains the standard bearer of the Republican Party, even for those who maybe wish that it wasn't so. But particularly for those who wish it wasn't so, many of them are not really active within the party, don't feel that the party has a home for them, or if they're in Congress, you know, they don't serve in Congress anymore, right? You know, that permission structure to be an alternative to Donald Trump right now doesn't exist in the party, and the party culture is one that is been traditionally very good about getting behind the standard bearer, right? And so in that regard, I think that Nikki Haley, while she has certainly a number of contrasts that she uses to good effect, it's just not selling with the Republican primary crowd, Republican office holders crowd at this point, right? On the Democratic side, you see from President Biden's write-in response, right? He gets over 60% of the vote in a write-in. And that takes some degree of effort and coordination, right, among folks that he too will secure the nomination. Most people have no earthly idea who Representative Phillips is, right, who is the main quote alternative to President Biden. That doesn't mean that folks on both sides of the aisle don't necessarily, they wouldn't prefer somebody else, but they're going to go right now with who's bringing them to the dance, so to speak.
Rosalind Cooperman is the professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Affairs at the University of Mary Washington down in Fredericksburg, Virginia, located about an hour south of us. Dr. Cooperman, we really thank you for your time this week.
My pleasure.
You're listening to VOA's Issues in the News. I'm Steve Miller. This week, Russian President Vladimir Putin met on Wednesday with Chadian leader Mohammed Idris Deby at the Kremlin. Putin is courting a country that had previously maintained a pro-Western policy and spurned Russia's recent outreach to Africa's Sahel region. Deby has led Chad since 2021 when he took power in a coup shortly after his father, long-serving President Idriss Deby, was killed in a battle fighting anti-government rebels. The junta initially promised an 18-month transition to elections, but later delayed them until October of this year. Putin told Deby at their meeting that he was following the situation in Chad in the fight against terrorists and expressed his condolences on the death of his father. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a four-country tour of democracy-supporting countries in Africa. During his stop in Nigeria, he also spoke about security.
The United States will support Nigeria as it works to bring about a more secure, a more peaceful, and a more prosperous future for its people.
To discuss these visits and their potential impact, I spoke with Christine Cheng, senior lecturer in war studies at King's College in London, via WhatsApp. Christine, I guess where I want to begin is that we have these visits, United States going to Africa, the leader of Chad going to Moscow. It's the second trip by an African leader to the Kremlin in recent times. You know, why are Washington, why is Moscow pursuing, you know, relationships with various countries around the African continent?
If we just take a little bit of a step back and think about what is going on in the world right now, we are at what I think of as an inflection point in geopolitics. And there is a lot going on, and you see the balance of power changing around the globe. So I would say that you can see China on the rise. I think that's pretty darn clear. And you can see that the US is trying to keep China at bay. Russia and China are very tightly aligned with each other. So if you think about that relationship working together, and then you think about what's going on in Ukraine, you can see that the rest of the world is sort of in play. And that sounds like an oversimplification and an unfair way of characterizing, you know, billions of people. But you know, strategically, in a great power sense, that is kind of what is happening, that the rest of the world is in play. So who is up for grabs? Well, we've got the Middle East, we've got countries in Asia, in Latin America to a lesser extent, and certainly in Africa. And I think that is a large part of the answer to your question. Why are people paying attention now? Why are these trips being made with more frequency and intensity, maybe than they have been in recent years? It's really because there is this geopolitical struggle going on, and people are looking to get some kind of strategic alliance advantage, whatever you want to call it, with countries in Africa.
Given, as you say, you know, the importance that some are placing on the African continent by the involvement by the three major powers, you know, where is the focus, and what do the respective nations hope to get out of it?
The focus is definitely on security, and you can see that both in the kinds of conversations that they're having and in the places that they're visiting, right? So if you think about there's been a recent spate of coups, mostly in West Africa, but expanding beyond that. And one of the places where a coup took place was in a country called Niger. So Niger is a former colony of France. And you can think of that as an interesting test case for where this battle for favor is going on. So Niger has been a place that the West has targeted for investment and thought that it was relatively isolated from being taken over, you know, as a military coup site. But in fact, that is what happened. It was taken over in a military coup. And then you could see the change and the shift in the aftermath of that. And you can see that country that the West had spent so much time, effort, and was about to, well, has built a military drone base on, that is now a little bit more of a question mark than it was. All that to say that these security issues are pretty serious. And when you've spent a lot of time thinking that this place is definitely on our side, we've got a strategic alliance with this particular country, and then it's toppled in a coup, then you have to wonder, where else could this take place? How secure are our other military and economic and just general alliances?
What are the things that you're looking at closely that may perhaps fall underneath the radar of others?
I would honestly probably pay more attention to China in this conversation rather than Russia. I think Russia has a certain set of interests that are partly, they really come out of the war in Ukraine. And for Russia, what they want to do is turn the tide of public opinion in Africa and turn this into an anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist kind of interpretation of that particular war, even though in the West, you know, we would largely think of it as purely an imperialist and purely a colonizing kind of endeavor. But their narrative and their goal is to try and change how people see that particular war, to change the mood music around how what the West is trying to do, and to line itself more tightly with, I think, how the Chinese are perceived, right, in a more neutral way. So I think thinking about it from the Russian perspective, that is what is at stake. But if you think about what is going on in terms of investment from China into Africa, that money and that those trade flows are just many, many, many times more coming from China than they are from Russia. So China is a much, much bigger player in Africa than Russia is. And in fact, I would say it just falls down the ranks in terms of trade and cooperation. So China is just the much more important player here in Africa. And that's the thing to pay attention to. Not so much, even though this trip is timely and interesting, the bigger things that are going on are around things like strategic minerals and who has control over those in places like the DRC. Those are the things that I would be paying more attention to strategically. And I would also be looking at what happens in edge cases like Niger, where it seems like things could go either way. And I think part of the answer to this is that Western countries are going to have to make alliances with leaders that they don't necessarily approve of in liberal democratic terms. And that's going to be a tough conversation at home.
Christine Cheng is a senior lecturer at the War Studies Program at King's College in London. Christine, thank you very much for your time and your insight today.
You're very welcome. Happy to do it anytime, Steve.
The United Nations top court on Friday stopped short of ordering a ceasefire in Gaza in a genocide case, but demanded that Israel try to contain the death and damage in its military offensive in the tiny coastal enclave. Joan Donahue is the president of the International Court of Justice, and she read aloud six so-called provisional measures to protect Palestinians in Gaza.
For these reasons, the court indicates the following provisional measures. One, by 15 votes to 2, the State of Israel shall, in accordance with its obligations under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, in relation to the Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention, in particular, A, killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. The State of Israel shall ensure, with immediate effect, that its military does not commit any acts described in point one above. The State of Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. The State of Israel shall take immediate and effective measures to ensure the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The State of Israel shall take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of Article 2 and Article 3 of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide against members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. The State of Israel shall submit a report to the court on all measures taken to give effect to this order within 1 month as from the date of the order.
In the highly anticipated decision made by the panel of 17 judges, the International Court of Justice also decided not to throw out the case. Friday's decision is only an interim one. It could take years for the full case brought about by South Africa to be considered. Israel rejects the genocide accusation and had asked the court to throw out the charges. As the world marks Holocaust Remembrance Day on Saturday, many people in Israel are comparing the genocide of the Holocaust to the Hamas massacre of October 7th. Some of those affected by October 7th were Holocaust survivors themselves. Linda Gradstein visited Kibbutz Nigba in southern Israel to bring us this story to round us out.
Tzvi Salo was a five-year-old in Warsaw when World War II began. He fled with his family to Italy, Greece, and Australia, and finally found refuge in 1959 in Kibbutz Nirim on the border with Gaza. Hamas gunmen attacked Nirim on October 7th as part of terrorist attacks on Israel that left 1,200 dead, including five in Nirim. 240 people were taken hostage, including Salo's next-door neighbors.
We woke up at 6:30 in the morning because of the shooting outside, and we heard people speaking, screaming in Arabic, running in between the houses. So we locked the door and we waited till the army relieves us, but it took them 7 hours.
At age 89, Salo says he suffers most because he had to leave his kibbutz home of almost 70 years, and he's not sure when it will be safe for him to return. He says the ordeal has brought back memories of his childhood fleeing the Nazis and being a homeless refugee for many years. Polish Holocaust survivor Sarah Jackson says having to evacuate Kibbutz Sa'ad, where she lived for six decades, has also brought back childhood memories of being a refugee. During the October 7th attack, Jackson hid for hours in her home bomb shelter together with six young people who fled the Nova Music Festival massacre. Some of them recently visited her to express their gratitude.
Those lovely people came into my house. I don't remember if they asked permission. They went to the front door, they locked the door, and I have a very big armchair in the corner, and they put the armchair to the door, and we all went into the shelter.
Historians say the Holocaust is still very much part of the Israeli consciousness, and that a sense of collective trauma may have been triggered by the October 7th attacks. Robert Rosette is a senior historian at Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Remembrance Center in Jerusalem.
There were things that happened on the 7th of October, like people being locked in safe rooms for a long time, which reminded people very much of what was happening in ghettos during roundups during the period of the Holocaust.
Hamas gunmen shot and seriously wounded Nova Music Festival attendee Tomer Zadik as he hid from them. Zadik's great-grandfather Jacob survived the Holocaust by jumping off a train headed to Auschwitz.
8 years after that, we have our own country. And Jacob's great-grandson in the country that Jacob helped build in order for something like that to never happen again, found himself hiding in the woods for hours after being shot, fighting for his life and waiting to get rescued. And I think this terrible similarity between my story and the story of my great grandfather really comes to show you what happened on October 7th.
The trauma of October 7th, like the trauma of the Holocaust, is something that Israelis will live with for generations. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Kibbutz Negba.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, we thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Be sure to join us again next week for more issues in the news. Until then, I'm Steve Miller.